So today I'm going to talk about using these iron lines that we've heard a little bit about yesterday from David and from Jeremy and from Chris Fragile. I'm going to sort of turn it around. Typically when I give a talk about iron lines, the focus is really on what we can learn about the black hole. And Omar said, well, why don't you try to talk about what we actually learn about the disk and what we might be learning about the corona using these iron lines. And insofar as there's an interaction between whatever kind of corona suits your fancy and the disk, we should be able to learn something via these lines. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reviewing the lines. We got some background yesterday. And as well, I'm happy to acknowledge that these lines are sometimes the subject of controversy. And so I'm not going to devote a lot of effort today into trying to prove that these things are absolutely required. I think they are. I've got a presentation that I think addresses many of the important concerns regarding these lines, and if you want to ask me about that afterwards, I'll be very happy to go through these arguments with you. So I can actually get to the constraints that they make on the accretion flow today, I'm going to largely give that a miss and move straight to other issues. So let me just start with the punchlines, because if your attention span is like mine, it's important to get these out right at the start. I think that these do have strong implications for the nature of the accretion disk. In particular, since these iron lines are the only discrete spectral features that we see from the inner disk which are common to stellar mass black holes and AGN, they can tell us a lot about the inner disk in both. And I think it turns out that they show that the inner disk and the inner disk interaction with the corona in both stellar mass black holes and in some Seyfert galaxies really must be, in fact, remarkably similar. As to the nature of the corona, it's a little bit harder to say anything specific about the corona. I think via iron lines, what we can do is say what the corona is not. And in particular, I think it's not necessarily a big, fluffy, quasi-spherical thing, and I'll try to give you some evidence along those lines. I think that one thing that we can particularly look to do in the future when we have ASTRO-E, so when we have higher effective area and better spectral resolution, we can begin to push on lower flux states, and so lower luminosity and lower fractional Eddington accretion rates. And so using these lines, I think we can begin to understand where transitions from an optically thin inner advective flow to an optically thick disk might occur, and we can begin to decide how much of the action is due to a jet and how much is due to an eta. And finally, I'll present some data on galactic black holes showing that they likely have what could be described as a warm absorber that's very likely a sort of a disk-driven outflow. And this doesn't have anything to do with relativistic iron lines, but I think it's sort of pertinent to the discussion that we're having. So, as we've seen countless times, this is sort of the basic inner geometry we're going to assume, a cross-section of a disk, and ridiculously idealized corona, sort of a lamppost model of hard X-rays which illuminate the disk. And so as an observer, what you see is direct disk emission, direct emission from this corona, whatever it might be. And the interaction between the corona and the disk, where the corona irradiates the disk, and you see what's known as a reflection spectrum, the most prominent part of which is this iron line. And just briefly, when you illuminate a slab of cold material with a power loss, say, the disk reaction looks like this. It's a series of K lines from astrophysically abundant elements. There's nothing special about iron, of course. It's just abundance times fluorescent yield that makes it the strongest line that you see, and so the most useful diagnostic. If these lines are actually being excited at the inner disk, then, of course, they're subject to the special relativistic shifts and gravitational redshift that we expect to be endemic in that region. And so if we make relativistic line profiles and fit them, what we've actually done is build up a library of these effects, and we've adjusted them for inclination, the effects are dependent on radius, outer radius, emissivity of the disk, and so forth. And so what we're fitting is actually an average line profile. And one of the most important things I think we can get out with these line profiles optimally is about the spin of the black hole. In particular, since the innermost stable circular orbit can extend to 1.25 m instead of 6 m for a maximally spinning black hole, we should see an enhanced red wing from iron lines around spinning black holes. And I think that there is good evidence that some of the lines from not just Seyferts but galactic black holes actually do show evidence for spin in the form of a very strong red wing. But before I move on, I want to say just a little bit about why it is that you would really try to use an iron line anyway. Obviously, there's a lot more photons in the disk. There's a lot more photons in the power law. More than that, you can get really good constraints on the disk and the power law from a couple kiloseconds with XTE. You don't need to spend 100 kiloseconds with XMM as we have to see these iron lines often enough. And I think the answer is partly that the continuum models might actually be more degenerate than the iron line. And here what I'm showing you is an intermediate or high soft state of Cygnus X1 observed with OSCA. These are the gas detectors. These are the exact same spectra. One's plotted in black, one's plotted in red. They've been fitted with the same multicolored disk, sort of standard naive disk model, but with different power law, different models for the hard X-ray emission. One's just a power law, one's the COMP-TT model, which is self-consistent Compton-up scattering from the disk. They're statistically equivalent. In both cases, you can see that there's this nice iron line here, but you really can't tell these fits apart statistically. But in fact, they're giving you very different constraints on your disk, even though you have the same disk model. And here I'll illustrate that. This is the same fit, so the same spectra, and I've zeroed the disk normalization. You can see in the one case that when you fit with the Comptonization model, you end up with a much stronger disk than in the other case. The temperatures differ by a factor of 20%. The normalizations differ, in fact, by 2. So you're going to get much different constraints out of your disk when you rely on continuum fitting of these X-ray spectra of stellar mass black holes than if you were to use the iron line, which you can see is actually very similar between these fits. It's actually the case that for a broad range of plausible continuum spectra, the iron line is more robust against continuum variations than, say, the disk is. So this is one of the best motivations for trying to use these iron lines, which, granted, are 5 and 10% features, as you can see. But there's really strong motivation for doing so. And to hammer that point home just a little bit more, here's some spectra from GX339-4 as observed with Chandra, and from XTJ1650-500 as observed with XMM. And these are ratios to a disk plus power law, a bulk motion Comptonization model, and a disk plus a COMP-TT model. This one's blowing up a little bit. It's not a good overall fit. But these line profiles are remarkably robust against changes in the continuum. So I think that it's true that we can infer pretty robust things about the black hole and the accretion flow using these lines. So let me come to some statements that I think we can make about the nature of the disk with these iron lines. But first let me say, I think these iron lines in the Seyfertz are actually fairly common. Here's just sort of a gallery of them. The best case is, of course, MTG63015. Due to inclination effects and or additional iron line emissions, say from the torus, some of them have rather stronger blue wings than others. In this case, it's not just a blue wing, perhaps, but actually narrow emission from the torus. And I think following the OSCA era, there was some concern that maybe these lines weren't really being found with Chandra and XMM anymore. I think that comes about in part because people were very excited about iron lines in the OSCA era. And if you look at the Nandra paper, which lists a whole number of AGN which have iron lines, you make a simple cut and you say, I'm going to require that the full width half max of the lines divided by the error in the full width half max is greater than 2. And you only want to believe those lines, just as an initial cut. All of those lines are again seen with Chandra and XMM. So the lines that we should have had cause to believe strongly in the first place are again observed with Chandra and XMM. I think what's changed a bit in the past several years is that it's been seen that these lines are actually fairly common in galactic black holes. And again, this is just a gallery. The most strongly redshifted and highest spin cases really do seem to get dragged down to 4 keV or so. You can see that in 1650 and in 1655. So here I'll show just two of the best examples of the iron lines. What do these really tell us about the disk? I think they're saying, first of all, that the disk and their disk corona interaction in Seyfertz and black holes, stellar mass black holes, is likely really very similar. We can fit these spectra of MCG-63015 and 339-4 using the same reflection models, which we blur with the relativistic line function. In this case, both require spin because we get an inner radius for line emission, which extends well inside of 6M. it turns out that the only real tweak between these is just a question of ionization. So as David mentioned yesterday, in a number of these Seyfertz, the disks seem to be mildly or moderately ionized. In galactic black holes, they seem to be highly ionized. And I'm thinking of log ionization parameters here between 3 and 4. In some cases, in fact, it seems like we've not seen iron lines in the galactic black hole disks, perhaps because they're incredibly highly ionized. And that seems to preferentially be the case in high inclination systems, which tells you that there might be scattering through a disk atmosphere, which perturbs that problem even worse. But in general, it seems like these are highly ionized lines, and these lines tend to be the hydrogen-like or helium-like charge state, and these are largely consistent with neutral lines. And as great as that is, or at least I think it's great, I think that really is only just what we'd hoped to do with iron lines in the first place. It's only sort of fulfilling the promise that we had always hoped would be there. I think what we can try to do now is really look at the variability of the iron lines to try to infer more about the disk. And Jeremy showed this a bit yesterday. This is one such effort that I made with Jeroen Homan in Black Hole 1915 plus 105. These are counts versus time, 20 seconds, two different QPOs, 1 hertz QPO and a 2 hertz QPO, which are so strong, 12% RMS, that they're readily visible in the naked light curve here. All we did was just take count rate cuts and make, here you can see the QPOs in the power density spectra sense. What we did was to take count rate cuts here and isolate the peaks and troughs of the QPOs, and then to make iron line profiles. And in fact, what you see here is just a different spectrum. This is just a ratio of the counts with no fitting. The detector response has not been taken out. This has not been manipulated by my hands in any sense. You can see what happens is in the high phase of the QPOs, an iron line pops out. And in this plot, the errors on these deviations are actually comparable to the plotting line width. So it's a very strong deviation. And in fact, what is seen is that the flux and equivalent width of the iron line is stronger at the top of the QPO wave than at the bottom. So this begins to suggest that you're seeing something that might be like precession. You might have a quasi-periodically changing projected reflector area. You can imagine that if you're seeing something like this at one phase, when the disk is pointing towards you a little bit more, you see a little bit more of the disk. When it comes away from you, you see less. This might be one way of explaining these QPOs and iron lines self-consistently. Regardless of whether or not that particular interpretation is right, it does seem suggestive of an inner disk structure, whether it be a warp or a hot spot, but some inhomogeneity in the inner disk in these galactic black holes. And I think iron lines are beginning to show us some of the same things in AGN. A 1 or 2 hertz QPO in a source like 1915 is not that close to the innermost stable circular orbit. It's actually rather pushed back if you just use a Keplerian frequency. In fact, I'm sure these frequencies come from closer to the black hole. But in AGN, due to the time scales, you can see that orbital time scale in real time. And this is a trailed map of excess iron emission in the AGN NGC 3516. This is work by Iwasawa, Minuti, and Fabian. And what you see is some modulation of the line flux to the red in a rather sawtooth pattern indicative of motions around the very innermost part of the black hole. Now, granted, this isn't 100% compelling, but I think it's at least a 3-sigma result, and I think it's terribly interesting. And these do perhaps tell us about different orbital timescales, but I think they point towards the same thing, and that is an inner disk structure which may be something like a spiral wave. And finally, what we're learning about disks from iron lines, I'll end with sort of the most speculative thing, I think. The most extreme lines seem to require heightened inner disk emissivity. So if you expect emissivity goes as r to the minus q and q minus 3, one on r squared for simple distance dilution, another one on r due to an angle factor, minus 3 is expected, and what we see is something in the range of 4 to 5. It's perhaps suggestive that there's extra energy being dissipated in the inner disk. And so it might be the case that we're seeing energy input into the inner disk via coupling to the black hole, so perhaps through the Langevin-Nijek process, or perhaps through connections to the plunging region. I think this is a very exciting possibility, I think that it's at this level only a possibility. And since I'm talking to theorists predominantly, I think it's fair to admit, you know, you'd probably like to know on which of these things would the observer bet his house. Well, I might not bet my house on much of it, but I'd bet my car that these things are really iron line profiles that might well require spin. Are we really seeing these things yet? I'm not quite sure. It certainly is what the data require with good confidence, but I think that this sort of thing is one of the most sketchy inputs into these line models. But we are beginning to see this effect in a number of black holes right now, so it's something to sort of keep our eye on. So moving on to what we might be able to say about the nature of the corona using these iron lines. There are models that one can make for these black holes at their very highest accretion rates, where you lose sight of the inner disk, whether it's because you have an optically thick photosphere that's, say, optically thick at 100 radii or so. King and collaborators have recently proposed this. Or perhaps you just build up a bit of a corona that has a sizable optical depth, and so you're looking through some sort of Compton fog, and you're not really able to see to the inner disk. Well, I think this is not likely the case. I think what iron lines are telling us is that we have a very clear view of the inner disk, even at the highest mass accretion rates. This is a plot of the ASM, XTE ASM count rate from 1550 minus 564, and this spans about a year. 1550 is famous for many things, but also because of its six crab flare there, which you can see. And luckily, XTE managed to observe a few times during that flare. What I'm showing you here is the iron line that was observed during that flare. It's very strong. This is a 5% modulation here, and the error bars are incredibly small relative to that. It's impossible to slide a plausible continuum model through this data that disappears the iron line. So that indicates already that we're likely seeing down to the inner disk, even in the very highest parts of the very high state. But beyond that, I think we have some corroborating evidence, and that comes from timing. This is the power density spectra from that flare. You see a strong 12 Hertz QPO as well as 180 Hertz QPO. As Jeremy mentioned yesterday, trying to take these frequencies and make them hard by scattering them through a corona is not a good way to preserve the frequencies. You end up scattering them away. And in fact, this is likely what's going on in a system like Cygnus X3, which may be a black hole which is accreting from a Wolf-Rayet star. There's a very dense stellar wind in that system, and there's no important timing features. It's 1 over F at very low frequencies, and then there's nothing at high frequencies. There's no quasi-periodic phenomena in Cygnus X3, for instance. I think one of the things that we can try to probe, because we get spin constraints out of these iron lines, is the relation between spin, corona, the corona, and jets. It does seem to be the case, at least right now, I mean, these are limited number statistics, aren't they, that those black holes which have the most relativistic jets, V over C in excess of 9, do also seem to have the most skewed line profiles. So the line profiles and jet velocities, if we use jet velocity to be a probe of the linear velocity at the inner orbit, they seem to agree that these black holes are spinning. These also happen to be the black holes that have heightened emissivity profiles. So whether or not there's a link that directly, whether or not there's a direct link between black hole spin and relativistic jets, I don't think we can say for sure at this point. It may only be sort of a special configuration of the corona which makes that possible. But in the cases that we are able to have, in the cases for which we have very good radio coverage, and we've seen these plasmoid ejections, and for which we have very good iron lines, so far the case looks very good. And we can wonder sort of where does this leave C41s, because often enough these are radio quiet. But I think it's important to remember that radio quiet is not the same thing as radio off. And in particular, you know, David showed us yesterday that there is evidence for relativistic line in one quasar. There's also evidence for relativistic line in this quasar 0057. And if, in fact, as Andrew Wilson pointed out, these quasars are generally more distant, the quality of the spectra that you get is necessarily less. If you're going to miss an iron line, one way to do it is to make that iron line very, very skewed, so it's a lower contrast feature. So hopefully one of the things that, say, AstroE can do is help us to see whether or not there's a very skewed line in these quasars. That would fit with this picture. There is a wrench in the works that I'll freely admit to. There is a neutron star, Cercinus X1, and we know it's a neutron star because it's shown X-ray bursts. It has jets greater than 0.9C. This is work by Fender et al. I think this analysis likely holds up, and if it does, it means that black hole spin isn't the only, or maybe not even the most important ingredient in driving the most relativistic jets. I think there are some difficulties with this analysis because it's not following a single plasmoid out. It's watching brightening in a few knots. And if you've sequenced if you've got the sequence of variations in the source and downstream in the jets misaligned, and they've only watched two cycles, then you could easily infer a velocity that's too high. So I don't think that the final word on this result has been written yet. But if it's right, then we lose sort of the spin-jet connection. And finally, one thing that's perhaps coming out from new studies of iron lines, and in particular iron line variability, it's been shown that in some Seyferts, the iron line does not track the continuum in a simple way in all flux states. It seems to track the continuum in a sensible way, that is, in the way you'd expect through naive reflection models, at low flux states, and Chris Reynolds has shown that recently with MCG6. But often what we assume is that we have a corona which has a variable flux. Instead, it might be possible to describe the variations seen in accreting black holes with a corona that has a more or less constant flux, which moves in height above the disk, and due to its changing proximity to the black hole, there's changing gravitational light bending. So when it's close, you focus more hard X-ray emission onto the disk, and you get a stronger iron line. When the source is farther away, you get a weaker iron line. And this predicts a specific line flux, power law flux trend like this, and this is seen in MCG6 and perhaps also in 1H0707 in the Seyfert cases. It's perhaps also seen in a galactic black hole XTEJ1650-500, and you can see the turnover here. Interestingly, this phase one, when the source would be closest to the black hole itself, and when light bending would be strongest, these are very high state observations. So this is also the case where we see the high frequency QPOs preferentially, where we see the strongest iron lines. And so it's sort of interesting that this would, within the context of this model, that's when the source would be closest to the black hole. However, I think an analysis we recently did of these data, although qualitatively suggests this might be the better model, it's very hard to rule out changes in the disk ionization to explain these line flux, continuum flux variations. And so I think another thing to look for in the future is sorting out, you know, whether or not we've got a corona which is intrinsically variable or which is relatively constant and just moving. I think that we can do that with better data, even with just XTE. So I may end with the nature of accretion into black holes at low mass accretion rates. I think that iron lines can really help to give us useful constraints on where we see an optically thick disk get truncated in these sources. And here I've sort of made two cartoons which paint an extreme. So in one case, we might have an ADAF around the black hole and a truncated inner disk. This isn't necessarily very efficient at irradiating the disk. Because the disk is truncated, we have a narrow iron line. Also because it's truncated, we have a small omega over 2 pi covering factor, and we have weak reflection. If we were to have a jet-dominated geometry, and for the sake of argument, a disk which extends close to the black hole, and say some synchrotron self-Compton which is shining up and down, we would tend to have a strong broad line because the disk extends in, and we would again have a low reflection fraction because we're fooled about how much of the power law or corona emission we're seeing directly. So you think you have more than you do, and you end up with a low reflection fraction. The difference between these two is really the width of the iron line. I think we have some data that can begin to bear on this question presently, but nowhere near enough. What I'm showing you is a ratio from an XMM long hard look at GX339-4 in the low hard state. It was observed at a couple of percent of Eddington for about two orbits. It's probably the best low hard state spectrum we have of a galactic black hole. What I'm showing you is the ratio of the spectrum to a simple power law model. If you only look in the XTE band, you'll never see the disk. You'll be completely content with the power law fit And from that, you might well infer that there is some sort of truncated disk in the system. Instead, what you see is some optically thick continuum disk emission down here when you look at, when you use a spectrometer that goes down to lower energies. As I said before, I'm not sure that with the present disk models, I'd have you believe much of what comes out when I try to pull parameters from this disk, but I don't think that we have to rely only on that. There is a very nice, perhaps even double-peaked iron line profile on this low hard state that very strongly suggests that the disk is extending inward to the innermost stable circular orbit in the system. So here, we can use an iron line to say something very conclusive, I think, about the location of the disk at low m dot. It's not just, you might ask, well, is 339 weird? I think not. This is the same game with Cygnus X1, and this is just archival OSCA data. Again, you see that there's this strong 0.2 keV disk. If you zoom in on the iron line, well, in Cygnus X1, there's never been any evidence for spin, either from QPOs or from iron lines. The iron lines don't reach much below 5 keV. They don't require an inner radius very close to the black hole. Standard Schwarzschild radius will do. A standard radius for a Schwarzschild black hole will do. But once again, you see correspondence between the iron line and the disk. It seems like these disks are not truncated. And finally, even in the case of XTEJ 1118 plus 480, if we play this game there again, and we take the Chandra low energy grading spectrum of it, and we bin it to 15 counts per bin, fit between 2 and 10 keV, look at what's left over, it's again a large soft excess which can be modeled with the disk. So in this case, we don't have the statistics to see the iron line. And it's perhaps partially due to the fact that this source is very high inclination, 81 degrees. This would have the effect of, the Doppler effect then would have the effect on the data of pushing the wings quite far apart. The blue wing would be out, say, at 8.5 keV. I don't think the data are really saying that that's there. I'm just saying that we can't rule out a broad iron line consistent with the disk at the innermost stable circular orbit based on these data. So to take stock of the low hard state, I think that for a range of Eddington accretion rates, which are coming down pretty low, based on the iron line and or disk, we're seeing that the disk might yet be there, which means that within the context of ADAF models, the optically thick disk getting truncated must occur at a lower accretion rate. And I think that this must be, this technique of using the iron line to make this determination is particularly important in cases like low luminosity AGN. In the galactic black holes, we can rely on the fact that we have an X-ray disk to check our iron line results. In M81 star at NGC 4258, we don't have that continuum mission. We have to rely on the iron line. But I think maybe the galactic black holes can tell us that we can do so reliably. And so quickly to just race through, the last thing I wanted to mention, if Ron will allow me about 120 seconds more. It's been shown before that there are ionized absorption lines in galactic black holes, in particular in 1655 and 1915 with OSCA. And this is basically work by Ueda et al, who showed that there are hydrogen-like and helium-like iron absorption lines in the spectra of those two sources. What we found with Chandra is that in disk-dominated states, there are a whole range of other absorption lines which are very warm absorber-like. This is magnesium, the helium-like line from neon and neon 2 and neon 3. So certainly two rather different ionization states in these lines. The lines are blue shifted by a few hundred kilometers per second. The wind is likely clumpy to keep these from implying an absolutely huge outflow. We do not see these lines in the very high or low hard state. We have data with XMM, which covers those phases of this outburst. These lines are only present in the high soft state. It really looks like in the high soft state, these disks tend to blow off winds that may take about 10% of the mass inflow. I apologize for switching from angstroms to keV, but somehow when we get into the iron K band, I feel like I should do it in the keV. We also found evidence for a variable warm absorber-like structure in this black hole, H1743-322. Again, when the radio jet is on and when we're in the very high state, no observable absorption lines. But when we're in the soft state and the jet is off, we begin to see evidence for some hefty absorption lines. And one thing that was particularly interesting in this case, there's a very strong 250-second modulation in the X-ray flux during this observation. It's not quite a QPO. The Q value is about 1 or 1.5. But this varies significantly on that time scale. So if you imagine that you're looking at this source edge-on, and certainly dips seen in the light curve would indicate that we are, you might imagine that you're seeing some sort of outer disk precession, and that's occasionally coming into your line of sight and causing a modulation of relatively colder matter in the iron 25 line. We've also seen a lot more dramatic evidence for this effect in 1655 minus 40, where we just see a massive absorption lines in the soft state. And they're again outflowing at velocities consistent with warm absorbers in Seyfert AGNs. So to summarize, I think that basically iron lines really are very useful diagnostics for trying to understand the disk and the corona. I think that this issue of disk winds, which seems to be new for these sources, may be able to inform us about why there's warm absorbers or not in radio loud versus radio quiet AGN, but that's certainly work that's going to be in progress for a while. But since I'm talking to theorists, I feel like I can sort of make a bit of a wish list. One thing that I'd really like is a variable spin relativistic line model, and I think we're going to get that soon. I'd also like reflection models with a running ionization parameter. I can sort of learn something about the temperature profile of the disk or disk atmosphere in a secondary way to just disk continuum fits. But I also would like these generically called radiatively inefficient accretion flow models to be coded up for inclusion in the next spec. I think that Sarah Markoff is working on doing this for the jet models. And if I think that there's large payoff to be had here. I mean, if we learn that jets are only launched in systems that have a given transition radius or a given radiative efficiency, that will be very, very important. And so I think the things that we're going to care about as observers are things like photon index, the transition radius, fractional wind losses, perhaps some degree of convection, the radiative inefficiency, and if you can predict line strengths from these things, that will be very important. There's been one paper which tried to do this a bit. It's Narayan and Raymond, where they looked at a windy 8.5 outflow and tried to apply it to V404 Sig, a galactic black hole. Present observations are nowhere near to have the sensitivity to begin to test that, but maybe as we look forward to Astro-E, we can begin to push on things like that. So from an observational standpoint, having these things available for public use would be just fantastic. Thanks.
Questions?
For XGE J1118, if the standard thin disk can extend as close to the black hole as close as 2 Schwarzschild radii, then we should expect very strong emission at soft X-ray band. But on the other hand, I remember EUVE satellite tell us the spectrum have a very strong cutoff at the EUV band. So how do you explain this result?
I think that could. So the question was, if there really is a X-ray disk at 0.2 keV in 1118, how do I explain EUVE spectra, which suggests that the disk is not extending down that far? And I think that part of the answer may lie in the absorbing column that was chosen, since the UV is so very sensitive to the choice of absorbing column. Beyond that, I think it wouldn't be the first time that X-ray disks don't actually match on to lower wavelength spectra from the disk. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if there's not just a smooth run of temperatures in the disk.
The nature of the illuminating source, there are two obvious suggestions. One is that it's some Comptonizing cloud. The other, that it's some sort of flare, maybe prompt X-rays. In principle, those might be distinguished by looking at the high time resolution at the lags between hard and soft photons or line photons, since those are supposed to be fluorescent, reprocessed, and harder power law tail. Which comes first?
Well, I think the sad fact is that, I mean, to see iron lines as well as or as poorly as you think we do presently. I mean, that's an integration of tens of kiloseconds up to 100 kiloseconds just to see it that well. So maybe that's at the level where you could begin to see real variability. But in terms of watching the thing flare and seeing a change in the iron line profile to try to get at what you're, to try to answer the nature of what the corona is, we just don't have the effective area to begin to really do that right now. There is evidence, at least in the galactic black holes. In MCG minus 63015, there was, I apologize for not remembering the first author, there was a paper by a group of Italian authors that looked at the iron line response to a flare from in an XMM observation. And they did see that the iron line responded to the flare in a certain time scale that was commensurate with what you'd expect for the inner disk and commensurate with what you might expect for, say, magnetic flaring. So there's one observation anyway that seems to look like magnetic flaring.
You mentioned that for some galactic black holes, you see those warm absorber-like absorptions, and with the velocities actually very similar to those observed in some Seyferts. And in Seyferts, as we heard yesterday, there is this consensus now that warm absorbers are produced from dusty torus at large radii Galactic black holes, there is no dusty torus as far as I can tell. So it is a very interesting, I think, diagnostics for models for both types of systems.
I agree. And it could well be a coincidence, and there could be different driving mechanisms that cause these velocities, surely. But it seems suggestive that these velocity shifts are sort of similar. And it even makes you wonder if they're not being, if the wind isn't being launched from a similar range of radii and Schwarzschild units anyway, from disks in AGN and disks in galactic black holes. Yeah?
Would it be, for those radii where the wind is likely to be launched, is the disk big enough for the galactic black hole?
Yeah, if...
Candidates, how big are the disks? I don't remember.
In terms, well, it depends how you'd like to look at them. I mean, they get out to, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Schwarzschild radii, or several stellar radii, depending on how you like to think about it. In this case, the 250-second QPO, if that really is a modulation due to precession in the outer disk, which might be causing the apparent absorber feature, that translates to a radius of a few thousand or perhaps 10,000 Schwarzschild radii, which seems like a plausible radius at any rate.
You mentioned the broad iron line in 3 to 9 minus 4 in a low state as evidence for a disk extending all the way to the hole. But it turns out that a truncated disk with an ADAF inside will also produce iron lines, because an ADAF is not also produces its own iron line emission, and it turns out that that has roughly the right amplitude as well for producing the kind of lines you see. So it could be that the presence of a broadened line is not really a very sensitive discriminator between ADAF models and disk models.
Well, you might be referring to a paper with which I'm not familiar. The work I'm familiar with, which predicts lines from ADAFs, is this Narayan and Raymond paper where you have a wind outflow from your ADAF. And they do indeed predict line emission, but it should be narrow. And in fact, this has a very characteristic shape to it that's not readily explained via Comptonization broadening.
Yeah, the ADAF itself does it also. And the reason for that is that while the ions there are hot, the electrons are not. An ion moving in that flow sees the electrons around it at a temperature roughly of the order of 50 to 100 keV. And at these, the energies of those lines, there's still a significant fraction of the iron atoms that ions that could produce fluorescence. It's the flow is extended, but the actual electron temperature that matters for line formation is not all that high.
All right. Well, that's very interesting if this is, if it is possible. I really do think those that velocity range is really characteristic of Doppler motions, not from scattering in a hot flow, however. Maybe we should talk afterwards. You might know of a paper that I don't.
Yeah, I think it's an important point. So does anyone want to weigh in on this particular topic, line profiles from ADAFs? Okay, we'll continue offline. Chris?
I was thinking about ways to test the Bella-Borodov alternate model of the low hard state. So instead of having an ADAF, you have a moderately beamed emission from a jet. And while most of the galactic binaries are at fairly high inclination, there are a few that are at somewhat lower inclination. So if the Bella-Borodov model does work, we should see a systematic difference between the two. Do you know if there's any indication for that?
I don't know if there's an indication for that. And in terms of testing it, I see some pitfalls in terms of uncertainties in distance and uncertainties when you're trying to infer mass accretion rates via anything that you might... Any diagnostic of mass accretion rate is going to be largely uncertain as well. So when you first try to infer your isotropic luminosity, you use your distance, and then you try to use your mass accretion rate, and then you try to work out your beaming factor. I think it's going to be very hard to do, but I agree with you in principle that it could be done.
It's at the bottom of my wish list at the end of my talk is better masses, distances, inclinations.
Next question.
A question on the swarm absorber state that you say disappear. You're measuring it through line absorptions, is
yes.
that? Yeah. So I was just wondering if it could be any radiative effect. Then I can imagine several possibilities so it doesn't necessarily mean that it disappears in the jet state, it's just that you won't see it, either because the ionization state has changed, or for example, if the emission now, as has been suggested, is produced in a jet itself rather than in disk, then the region that would have been absorbing it is no longer between you and the continuum.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there. At this point, I'm not entirely certain that we fail to see these absorbing features in jet states just due to ionization reasons. In the case of 339-4, the lines are, when they are not observed, it's both in the very high state and in the low hard state, which spans about a factor of 30 in flux. So it seems, without having done the numbers properly, that would seem to suggest to me that it's not just a question of ionization. It might be a question of turning something on and off, but because 30 seems large for this purpose. But I think what you say is possible, and we need to do the work carefully.
Julian.
When you were discussing which properties can be derived reliably from the line profiles and which are sort of waffly, I think you correctly emphasized that when there's a broad red wing, you know there's some emissivity very close in, you know, whatever the details of the distribution. But I thought that it was also possible to use the position and shape of the blue edge as a way of constraining the inclination. And you didn't speak very much about it, so I was curious how much you can say, both in the case of AGNs and in the case of the black hole binaries. Where, of course, in the latter case, we may have other inclination indicators as well.
You're right, and that's an excellent point, and I think I skipped over it. Well, I actually don't know why I skipped over it. It should have been mentioned. The inclination does come from these line profiles. The inclination that I prefer to use as the standard against which to test how well the line models are doing is that from the jets. So insisting that the inner disk is anchored perpendicular to the jet axis. In cases where we know the jet axis with good accuracy, the iron lines are consistent with that inclination. That is to say, however, that there's often a factor of 10 or 15, 20 degrees uncertainty in that. So something like 339-4 or Cygnus X1 seems to have a low inclination, 15 to 30 degrees based on jets, say. It's true that there's no way to fit the iron line profiles we see by taking a line profile that's set at 70 degrees. That line profile will absolutely fail. But so this is one thing that we can begin to do with these line profiles. You're absolutely right. It's not great. And to get better constraints, I often prefer to try to fix that parameter where we know the jet angle very well, such as in 1915, it's 70 degrees plus or minus 1 or 2 degrees. That's great.
Okay, we'll have to take further questions at lunch with John. Let's thank him again for his talk.